when we're thinking about bribes, bribes are often quid pro quo. And that means is I give you something with the expectation that you're going to render something in return for that. And they're in fact understood as not sanctioned. They're not socially approved of.
Hello, and welcome to the Dell Podcast, where we bring you the latest management research and insights from the Desatel Faculty of Management at McGill University. Today, we're talking about bribery. Diana Daklalah, my colleague here at the Desatel Faculty of Management, is an assistant professor in organizational behavior. She's investigated bribery and indeed how to curtail bribery in the context of Moroccan hospitals. Her results give us a glimpse on how institutions could curb unethical conduct within their walls. And she joins us today to talk about it. My name is Saku Mantere, and I'm your host today. So today I'm talking to my colleague Diana Daklalah here at the Desatel Faculty of Management. So welcome to the Dell Podcast, Diana.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why do you find bribery interesting?
I think a lot of our social, a lot of our political, a lot of our economic lives are actually organized through state institutions, and it's very important that they function well. And when we think of something like bribery or any other form, in a sense, of behavior or any phenomenon that can limit, perverse, create barriers around access to some of the key functions and services that the state can provide, that's basically what draws me to the subject matter, to the extent also that trying to generate and improve the functioning of these state institutions is fundamental basically to what I think of as good government.
Why is that? Why is bribery so harmful to institutions?
It undermines confidence in the state. And in some instances, it can just limit opportunities for people as well. So there are material consequences for bribery.
So what would be a working definition of bribery?
Bribes are that extra, that additional those additional payments that you have to make, which are in fact illegal. They're not supposed to be made. So frontline workers or state employees are not supposed to be taking this money from you. But this money is being offered, or this money is being asked for many reasons. It could be because people feel like that could accelerate the services that they get. It could improve the quality. It could give them access that they wouldn't otherwise have. So there are many reasons for why people might want, or for why people might end up paying bribes. And often bribes are usually in the form of money. Money is fairly easy to exchange, particularly if you look carefully at how these transactions happen. These transactions are often secret, they're concealed. Often there are turns of phrase that are used largely to, you know, neutralize, in a sense, what's happening. And, you know, in other instances, it could be gifts that could be offered. And so it really depends. But oftentimes we would think of as money as being primarily what's being exchanged.
So you've studied the healthcare system in Morocco, and specifically, you know, the practices of accepting bribes in that context. Could you tell us a little bit more about your work in that context?
So a lot of my work on bribery is precisely focused on looking at how it happens inside organizations. And I think that's where the story needs to be in large measure. One of the things that I wanted to do was to say, okay, well, to really understand this systematically, we need to go drill down to the level of where these interactions happen. And they happen in public sector establishments, right? And in the case of healthcare, we're talking about public hospitals, for example.
So if I'm getting this right, you know, where you should look for bribery is in the context of an organization. So this isn't something that you find, you know, at the level of institution necessarily, or at the level of a cultural context, as much as you find it almost like as a sickness in a particular organization?
I think it's fundamentally, I mean, I don't know if you want to use the word sickness, you can, yeah, sure.
Well, you know, if you think that it's something that corrodes,
yeah,
you know, public institutions, then I would dare to
fair.
Use a metaphor like
fair.
That.
Fair, that's
so
fair
could
words.
We say that there are schools in public school systems where there's bullying, and that tends to be specific to you know, school organizations. So there are, you know, specific schools where there's more bullying than others.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a great analogy. And even within organizations, organizations are often divided up into work units. So you're going to see quite a bit of variation there.
So you have classes where there's a bullying problem.
For example.
You might have a ward where there are practitioners who take bribes.
Exactly right. And so what happens is you drill down to organizations and then within organizations as well. And now it opens up a very different world of possibility for understanding the problem and also for trying to find solutions for the to the problem. I think, you know, one of the key things is that it really roots the issue in organizational design, which I think is key. I think particularly when we think about public sector organizations or the public sector more generally, often when people think about corruption or bribery and solutions to it, they're often thinking about very blunt policy instruments. So they're like, okay, maybe we need to deal with, you know, enforcement, or maybe we need to, you know, adopt certain laws, or we need to. And so in a way, these blunt instruments don't really pay attention to the variation that's happening or even to root cause. And I think that usually when we think of the organization of work in an organization or in a work unit, people have more control over that. Across work units, what varies is the way work is organized. What varies is the kind of relationships that workers have with each other. It's going to be the same thing if you're looking across organizations as well. And so now the question is, what is it about, you know, the units where you have this higher incidence? Let's suppose we just focus on one organization. We find that, you know, bribery is salient in a few of the work units there. In the case of, say, a hospital, you know, there's one or two wards where it seems the rates seem to be highest, and then the rest, there really isn't much going on. So now you ask the question, well, what is it about these places? Why is it that in these wards we're seeing significantly higher rates than, say, other wards?
You've done all this fascinating research, and you've managed to at least convince me that bribery is something that you find at you know, the level of an organization, or even deeper in the organization, in a work group or a unit or what, however the organization is structured. Like, you were working in maternity hospitals?
Actually, what I did was they were general hospitals.
Okay.
That offered, you know, what you would think of as, you know, different kinds of care that are pretty standard. And the idea was to start off by mapping the incidence of bribery in the hospital. Turns out that across the hospitals that I mapped, there was a consistent pattern. And the consistent pattern was that maternity wards had the highest rates.
Okay, so let's look at those instances there. So, you know, why is it that they had this problem?
So right now what I have is a theory, and I think the argument is connected to the organization of work. When we look at the organization of work, one of the things that we notice when looking at spending time in these maternity wards is that midwives do quite a bit of the heavy lifting in terms of the amount of work that's done, whether it's the administrative, the care, the clinical work that happens. And in many instances, they're the ones who decide whether a patient is going to be seen even by a physician or not, or whether it's sufficient to just, you know, address the patient's needs only through the midwife, the core of midwives. But even though there's, and what ends up happening also is there's quite a bit of overlap in the kind of care work that doctors, right, in this case the specialists who would be the obstetricians, for instance, and the midwives do as well. But even though you have this overlap in work, even though you have this immense amount of responsibility and delegation of responsibility to midwives, the wage gap in terms of pay, it's a much bigger wage gap. And so what do we have here? The issue here is not that there's wage inequality, because wage inequality exists between nurses and doctors and other wards in the hospital as well. So that's not, and you don't have bribery, right? Either you don't have it or the rates are super, super low.
But it's fascinating because on the maternity wards, the roles or the division of labor is less clear.
And that's the argument, right? And the argument is, when you have wage inequality and you cross it in a sense, or have it interact with porous job boundaries or work that is not as well defined as it should be in terms of the allocation of responsibility, where people are in large measure perhaps doing significantly more in theory than, you know, they should be doing in terms of, you know, the kind of work that they're doing, then you might end up in a situation where a certain kind of rebalancing is going to occur. And when we think about the public sector, so here the question is, why does it have to be bribery? I think one way to rebalance or to make the correction is through bribe taking. But there are many other ways in which you can imagine rebalancing happening. People can rebalance by saying, okay, I'm just going to work, you know, I'm going to reduce the amount of effort that I put in on a job, right? When they experience this kind of asymmetry or imbalance, they could say, I'm going to moonlight. So moonlighting means that you're going to hold another job as well. Usually this refers to public sector workers who also work in the private sector within public sector work hours. But the reality is that any option that people go to is very much dependent on, I think, the nature or the constraints of the work. Now that means that organizations have three kinds of levers that are open to them to try and address this issue. So, you know, you can say, okay, maybe if we're going to keep sort of the same kind of division of labor, then perhaps we need to make certain wage adjustments for local wage adjustments, right, for this group, if that's possible. But then we know that when it comes to public sector institutions, they don't really have a whole lot of control over, you know, how they set wages. The alternative is to say, okay, well, how about we redesign jobs in a way where we do create clearer boundaries? And, you know, the third option is maybe you can end up with a combination of some combination of both. But the point is that now what you've done is you said, I'm looking at the level of the organization, I'm looking inside the organization, I'm figuring out how work actually is organized, what work relationships are like. This is a space that workers and managers have way more control over. They can shape it in a way that is meaningful to the everyday of the people coming in and offering their labor. In a way, I think that can result in, I would say, pretty positive changes, potentially.
I'm riffing here, but this almost strikes me as a procedural justice issue, that sort of they're witnessing something that's not fair, you know, there's, you know, and then they're rebalancing, as you said, by then taking bribes, because there's no other alternative. So where you see procedural injustice, you might find bribery if there's no other safety valve for rebalancing?
Possibly. And so the question here now is to understand, well, what's the trade-off? Like, what are the options that might be available? And so what's the logic of the trade-offs? And I think these are all open questions. And these are open questions. The reason that these are even questions that are generating themselves is because now we're shifting, in a sense, the way we're the focus and the level of the analysis when it comes to the problem. And a lot of the work that I've done is helpful in the sense that a lot of the patterns that I saw in terms of how bribery happens and where it happens have been generative when it comes to these questions.
So you've also talked about accountability in your work. So, and as I understand it, accountability is actually helpful for warding off bribery. How does that work?
So I've focused more on the issue of social accountability.
Social accountability. Okay, walk me through that concept.
So social accountability is very simply this idea that, well, first off, when people think about accountability in the context of organizations, I would say, you know, the initial reaction is to think about top-down monitoring,
yeah. Okay.
Right? And so that's often connected with what we might think of as, you know, more like punitive measures that are coming from the top down.
Right. And social accountability is more lateral?
More lateral or more connected to relationships in the workplace. So that might be with your peers, or it might be sort of with, you know, your supervisors, potentially. But yes, it's less about sort of the top-down, traditional top-down monitoring that you would see, and it's largely coming from your coworkers.
How can you get past the hurdles of sort of actually finding out about bribery? Because people don't really want to disclose that.
So I was able to document how patients received care. And maternity, pretty much as I said, emerged as the core, like the hub in a sense. In each hospital, it was a hub for bribery. And I thought, okay, well, let me focus my testing my intervention, which is focused on social accountability among coworker groups in maternity wards. And so what I did was I generated a one-page report for maternity wards in which I shared information about the percent of patients who reported paying bribes in their service. At the end of that report, I also notified them that I'd be conducting a second wave of data collection. And for that second wave of data collection, I was also going to be surveying patients, only next time I'll be breaking it down by type of provider. So in this case, it would be doctors, nurses, midwives, and it would also be circulated hospital-wide. So that was what you can think of as a visibility threat intervention, in a sense, where you've shared information about the occurrence of the phenomenon. Okay, so now they have a sense also of the prevalence of this phenomenon in their wards. But the key thing is basically saying that there's going to be further breakdown of that.
Okay, and so what were the results like?
So one of the things that happened, actually, and this was through the mapping exercise, was that, yes, maternity wards were a hub across hospitals, but they also varied in the amount of bribery that happened in the wards. So I was able to sort maternity wards into two groups, what I called the high baseline and what I called the low baseline group. The high baseline group, about half of patients reported paying bribes while they were hospitalized in the maternity ward. In the low baseline wards, between a quarter and a third of patients reported paying bribes when they were hospitalized in maternity wards. And one of the core results from the intervention was that the low baseline and the high baseline wards reacted differently to the intervention. In the higher incidence wards, healthcare workers cut back on taking bribes substantially. In the lower incidence wards, they maintained their activity levels.
So some amount of, you know, bribery is tolerated, but when it, you know, crosses a certain threshold, then these interventions might be more effective.
That is, in fact, my preferred interpretation, and I would say is consistent with the field observations and with, you know, the data that I collected. And so the idea here is to say that, yes, healthcare workers as a group seem to tolerate a certain degree of bribery in their wards up to a certain point, beyond which, in fact, they internalize the negative social consequences or sort of the social gravity of taking bribes. And based on that, they adjust their behavior.
How does your research influence decision makers that are the safeguardians of public institutions?
That's a great question. First off, I think it's important for policymakers in general to focus their level of analysis whenever they have a problem that's facing a particular sector at the level of their organizations. I think it's important to, you know, get a sense in terms of leveraging, you know, aggregate statistics at the level of a sector or at a national level, but I think it's really important to drill down to the level of the organization. That's one. Two, I think engaging in mapping, the kind of mapping exercise that I suggest, is going to reveal the local realities of a particular phenomenon that is facing an organization. And then the next step would be to ask yourself why. Why is it that you're seeing in the case of bribery, the level of bribery or the incidence of bribery in the hospitals that you have? I think what's important, though, is when it comes to, so one, drill down to the level of the organization. Two, think very locally about your problem. Three, consider how you can leverage local solutions. So what you can learn, so say it's a hospital, for example, what can you learn from your other wards where the problem is not showing up?
it seems that people are not really completely comfortable taking bribes. So it's not something that people get used to.
No.
So that also might be a pretty good insight to keep in mind. And I guess this notion that once you cross a certain level of tolerance, then mere, you know, pretty mild methods of intervention, such as, you know, just providing coarse grain information on how much bribery happens, then that might work in the areas where the threshold has been crossed.
I think certainly the idea of selectively leveraging these kinds of interventions is definitely one of the suggestions. But it's also important to recognize that if you wanted to selectively leverage some of these interventions, or an intervention like this one, this is a first test. It's in a sense of this. And so we need to understand a bit more. If the idea is that, you know, there is the role of thresholds thresholds are playing a role in terms of how responsive workers are potentially to such an intervention, then the next step is to understand what sets that threshold. Why? What's the reasoning behind it? What is that a symptom of? And is it possible then that we might be thinking of, would that bring us closer to root causes than we are today?
There's a lot of work to be done to understand why is it that bribery takes root in groups and organizations. And I'm really looking forward to hearing more as you progress. Thank you so much, Diana, for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, why don't you subscribe and recommend the show to a friend? This episode was hosted by me, Saku Mantere. It was produced by Robin McFadden and mixed by Eric DeCare. Original music by yours truly, Saku Mantere.